Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a talk by Bill Hayes, the director of John Brown's Cave Museum, part of the Mayhew Cabin and Historic Village in Nebraska City. He'll speak on the topic, The Fight Against Slavery on the Great Plains, Nebraska's Underground Railroad. This program, co-sponsored by Humanities Nebraska, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, February 10, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Metropolitan Community College, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College.
Today's program is called Fight Against Slavery on the Great Plains, and it features Nebraska's Underground Railroad. We will hear from Bill Hayes, who's the director of John Brown's Cave Museum, and he'll discuss the issue of slavery in the United States during the 1850s, the controversy surrounding the Kansas-Nebraska Act, explore the history of the Underground Railroad, and how the movement became connected with the Great Plains, as Hayes emphasizes specific sites where escaping slaves most likely found refuge on their journey north to freedom. Mr. Bill Hayes.
I'm very glad to be here. I'm glad you guys have come out to listen to me. I hope what I have to say is enlightening at times, but bear with me. There will be times where it probably feel like I'm jumping around, because I do, because all of a sudden I'll be talking and I'll say, oh, yeah, this was really important. But my name is Bill Hayes, and I'm with the Mayhew Cabin, John Brown's Cave Site, down the road in Nebraska City, Nebraska. It is considered the first recognized Underground Railroad site in the state of Nebraska. And I've been involved there. It's 2015, coming up on 9 years, I think. So, but anyway, you guys aren't here to listen to that. You're here to listen to me actually talk about the history of the site and everything. I guess the first thing usually I start off with is just a general definition of what the Underground Railroad is. And normally what we think of the Underground Railroad as the white abolitionist helping the African Americans escaping from slavery, and that's generally all we think about. But the National Park Service actually has a more, I wouldn't say a broader definition, but talks about that if there's any resistance to slavery or being enslaved, that's the story of the Underground Railroad. And they actually, in the late 90s, in 1998, they formed what they called the Network to Freedom Program. And the sites that can be listed aren't just sites of assistance like the Mayhew Cabin in Nebraska City, but also sites of escape, which we also do have in Nebraska City. Or sites where maybe a church, where enough of the congregation was involved in the Underground Railroad. So really, the Underground Railroad is the story of this resistance to slavery or being enslaved. Well, I'll get into how do we get an Underground Railroad. Well, the number one reason is, and really the reason is, the United States has the institution of slavery. And actually, let me see here. I'm gonna be moving back and forth here. And so I just put generally what we think of as a definition. Well, how did the Underground Railroad become known in American history? Well, a gentleman by the name of William Still, who was a free black in Philadelphia and actually helped on the Underground Railroad there, wrote a book in the early 1870s, but it really becomes part of American history or teaching American history when this gentleman, William Wilbur Siebert, a longtime professor at Ohio State University, started doing research in the 1880s and 1890s and published this book in 1898. And in talking about it, he actually said, hey, I want to find something that's really interesting part of American history that, you know, that the people were doing that was a good thing. And so this is something that he started to focus on. And especially being in Ohio, where there was quite a few Underground Railroad sites, he started putting a lot of his students to work, you know, research assistants and things like that, starting to do this do this work. Well, I'm going to start talking about kind of the history of slavery, not just in general, but how it affected the United States, and then starting to get how it came out here onto the Great Plains, and then really starting to get more into the Underground Railroad. Well, if we go all the way back, even before the United States is formed, you start to see the formation of the institution of slavery in the colonies, especially in the southern colonies like South Carolina, Virginia, because what they're doing, they're starting to base their economy off that. When the English are first settling here, they didn't necessarily just say right away, hey, we're going to have slavery, this is how we're going to do it. Early on, they had indentured servants, and what that meant, hey, these people who are living in England or somewhere, we're going to basically tell a person, hey, if you buy my way across the ocean, I'm going to work for you for 5 to 6 to 7 years, you know, to pay off my debt. And then at that point, they would be able to be free to do whatever they wanted to do. Well, that starts to change, you know, 4 or 5 decades after the founding of Jamestown in 1607. And you start to see more of this formation of the institution of slavery, and it exists everywhere. It's not just the South, it exists in the North. But when you get closer to when these colonists are fighting for independence, you see, especially during the American Revolution, you know, they're talking about, we don't want to be slaves, we want to be able, you know, taxation without representation, all that, and they start mentioning this, and they talk about liberty. Well, a lot of these people start to realize, like, well, this is pretty hypocritical. This is a contradiction. Here we are talking about liberty and freedom, yet we're denying it, you know, to other people. And so a lot of the states, even before the revolution's over, in the North, start to outlaw or abolish slavery. Well, the United States is formed, and during the Constitutional Convention, the issue of slavery gets brought up. Now, if you read the Constitution, even the original Constitution, they don't ever use the word slave or slavery, but it is there. Because one of the biggest debates was how to form a legislature. And that was, you know, was it going to be representation? Was it going to be equal? Well, one of the things they actually come down to, and it's, you know, if you guys learning in American history class, they talk about the three-fifths compromise. Well, what that means is all other persons, and they're talking about people who are enslaved, will count as three-fifths of a person towards representation. And so it's there. And one of the earliest, you know, and probably one of the most important laws that the United States government passes, even before the Constitution is ratified and becomes the United States form of government, is the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. And what happens with that is the United States, they just don't have the colonies on the eastern seaboard. When they get independence, they get all this land to the west of the mountains going to the Mississippi River. And so the Northwest Ordinance says, okay, this is how states, this is how people are going to be able to settle, you know, the people, the colonists, and the white settlers move west. This is how they're going to form governments, things like that. Well, it also said north and west of the Ohio River will ban slavery. So early on, you see this dividing line between free and slave states. And just a couple of years later, in 1790, there's another ordinance called the Southwest Ordinance passed. Exact same thing, except it says we're going to allow slavery. And so most of the time in American history, people don't move north to south or south to north generally. It's lateral. It's from east to west. And so when these people are moving west, if they're coming from Massachusetts and New York and Pennsylvania and moving to Ohio and Indiana, you know, they're taking their way of life with them, their beliefs with them. And so you start to see them become free states. Well, then people from Georgia, South Carolina, Virginia, they move west. They take their way of life with them. They take them slaves with them. So you start to see slave states. And in the first couple decades of the United States, you generally, when you're reading about it, you don't hear a lot about this issue of slavery. But, you know, it's kind of always there. It's I always like to use the analogy, say we're all sitting around eating. We're all at the table eating. And there just so happens to be there's a giant elephant at the table with us. Nobody wants to admit that there's an elephant actually sitting at the table with us. So we're just going to go all about our business and just pretend it's not there. And that's just kind of, it's like the elephant in the room. That's what this issue is early on. Because if you think about it, there is early on a balance between free and slave states. Anybody have any idea on why that would be important if you think about the way our government is set up? Yeah, if you had a majority of one side or the other, one side would probably vote to try and end slavery. And how many U.S. senators do we all get for each state? Two. And so that's why it becomes so important to say we want to have an equal number of free states and an equal number of slave states. Because each state gets two U.S. senators. And so early on, when Alabama becomes a state in 1819, you guys have any idea what the other state that comes in the Union about that same time? Illinois. Illinois comes in 1818, and actually Indiana is paired up with Mississippi. And so you see this balance already being kept. Well, you go forward, the United States has bought Louisiana Territory, they got the Louisiana Purchase, and so what happens is in 1819, 1820, where St. Louis is at, and a lot of people move there, they want finally to be admitted as a state. So the territory of Missouri is applying for statehood. There is a problem. There's about 10,000 slaves in Missouri Territory. And so, you know, a controversy pops up, and it's like, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to handle this? Well, finally, they reach what is generally known as the Missouri Compromise, or the Compromise of 1820, however you want to word it. And that is, we'll allow Missouri to enter as a slave state. And if you look at the map, the northern border of Missouri is now the farthest reaches of slave territory in the United States. Well, we're also going to break off part of Massachusetts and form the state of Maine. So that way we got one slave state, we got one free state. We want to keep this balance. And so another part of it is Missouri's southern border, the 36 parallel 30-minute, that becomes the U.S. government now has drawn a line that says, anywhere north of here, slavery is banned. Anywhere south of here in the Louisiana Territory, or what is left over Louisiana Purchase, slavery is allowed. And you guys got to remember that, because where we are standing right now, you know, was part of that Louisiana Purchase. And so if you're looking at the map, in 1820, is slavery going to be allowed or is it going to be banned? It's going to be banned. And that's what's... So that's how it's set up. So remember that. Well, what you start to see is people are pushing farther west, they're moving west, and you start to still see the different states come into the Union. The state of Iowa comes in 1846 as a free state. There's another state that comes into the Union about that same time. Texas, exactly, 1845. So you see, we're still keeping that balance. Well, finally, you get into the early 1850s, and you see they now want to open up this area for settlement. And there had been some resistance, because you got to remember, where we're standing, slavery's banned. This area shall be forever free. That's actually how it was worded in the Missouri Compromise. Well, you have these people trying to organize it and say, okay, we want to open this up for white settlers to move out here. Well, a lot of people in the South are resisting this because they know what that means. Hey, slavery's banned in this area. We know that's going to be more free states. We don't want that. Well, finally, the Kansas-Nebraska Act is put together. It's passed. And one of the compromises in there was to say that we're going to do popular sovereignty. We're going to allow people who move out there to Kansas and Nebraska to vote on whether there's slavery or not. And that is a big deal because less than 35 years before, the United States government just said this would be forever free. And now you're saying you're going to allow the possibility of the extension of slavery. And, you know, the Kansas-Nebraska, and originally it was just going to be one territory. It was always known as the Nebraska Bill. And then you get into the final stages of it, they created two territories, Nebraska and Kansas. And for history, when you're studying history, it's generally known as the Kansas-Nebraska Act. For what reasons? I don't know if it's just because of K before the N or what. But it was always known as the Nebraska Bill until right towards the very end. And I think probably part of it was, hey, you could have one territory become free and one territory be a slave territory. And so this conflict ensues over how are we going to, what's going to happen out here. And so you start to see people from the north, from Massachusetts, Indiana, Illinois, start to move and migrate to Nebraska and Kansas because they want to make sure it's a free territory because the federal government just threw out the window the Missouri Compromise. You guys said this would be forever free. Now you're saying it's not. Now you're going to allow the extension of slavery. We're not very happy right now. We're really mad, you know, that you guys just did this. So we're going to try and make sure this turns out right. Well, then at the same time, some states from the South, and especially the state of Missouri, are sending quite a few people into these areas, especially Kansas. Because if you look at Missouri, on its eastern border is Illinois. On its northern border is Iowa. They are both free states. Well, now, if you have Kansas as a free area, a free territory and free state, that's a big problem for the state of Missouri because now there's all these different avenues for people who are escaping out of slavery to make it into a free state. And so they start flooding into Kansas, and that's where you start to see the violent outbreaks. And this is the time when, you know, the Allen and Barbara Mayhew, they're the people that actually built the cabin down in Nebraska City. That's the time these people are living in. You know, it's, for some of them, and I know over and over again you hear it and you talk about it almost in any different age, but for some of these people it is Armageddon. It is the end of the world, you know, on what is happening. And so, you know, and people are moving out here and they're taking up arms to decide whether it's going to be free or slave. Now, a lot of the times I get the question, was Nebraska free territory? Was Nebraska slave territory? And the answer is usually, well, it wasn't really either. They never had a law for the first several years of the territorial days outlawing slavery, but at the same time, there were people who brought their slaves with them. And so, like Nebraska City, where the cabin's at, and this is important to remember, a lot of the people that moved to Nebraska City, and you find this in Kansas and Nebraska, you know, they moved, a lot of these people know each other, they moved to the same town, they share the same beliefs, and a lot of the people that moved to Nebraska City are actually from the South. They're born in the South, they're from, you know, they've lived in the slave state of Missouri, and they move here to Nebraska territory, and a lot of them do go to Nebraska City. Well, you know, some of them do bring their slaves with them. And so the two gentlemen that we see, Mr. Knuckles on the right, Alexander Majors on the left, they were both slave owners. They both lived in Nebraska City. And Mr. Knuckles is actually credited as the founder of Nebraska City. How many, raise a hands, how many of you know of the Pony Express? Quite a few of you. Well, Mr. Majors is actually one of the co-founders of the Pony Express. Originally, they just had a freighting company, and they became their headquarters became based in Nebraska City. Well, a couple years after that happened, they formed the Pony Express, which actually put them out of business. It bankrupted them. But that was one of the parts of history we remember. Well, they both brought their slaves with them. And it's interesting because Mr. Knuckles actually had a couple girls that escaped from him in late 1858, and I'll try to come back to that later because that's quite a story. And he actually tried to recapture them because you got to remember it's against the law to escape out of slavery. You're considered property, and so you can be recovered. And if people are helping you or assisting you or know anything about you being helped, you know, they can get in trouble with the law. You know, if you're helping somebody, you could actually be fined quite a bit of money, or you could be thrown in jail for months or for a few years. And so it's pretty dangerous. And actually, there's a couple other gentlemen that were slave owners in Nebraska City, and this is considered the only known published slave auction in what is Nebraska. And so this Charles Holly owed a debt to William Hill. All, like I said, all these guys knew each other before they came to Nebraska. Well, what they do to pay off his debt is they're going to auction off Judge Holly, as he is known, his two slaves. Known, and you can see towards the bottom, property, one Negro man and one Negro woman, known as Hercules and Martha. And that would have taken place in front of the courthouse in Nebraska City. And so, like I said, a lot of the people, especially in Nebraska City, now there were other communities in Nebraska that were anti-slavery, that were abolitionists, people who wanted to get slavery abolished. But in Nebraska City, that was not the case. And so, what you have happen is, like I said, it's for a lot of the people, it's a crisis. The 1850s, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, it's a big deal. You repeal the Missouri Compromise, you start to see these violent outbreaks. You start to see people like John Brown start to come back to become more involved in opposing slavery, because at this time, in 1854, 1855, when all this is starting to happen, John Brown had actually moved to upstate New York, and he was going to live out the rest of his life. But a couple of his sons were in Kansas and said, hey, we need your help. There's a lot of stuff going on here. We need guns. We need people. We need people out here to oppose the people who want to extend slavery, who want to bring slavery in this area. And so that's where you start to see the violence. And so for the first time in American history, you know, the United States government, you know, we don't have a civil war yet, but it's pretty close to it. Because here you have people who are pro-slavery or for slavery forming their own units and groups, and people who are anti-slavery and against slavery forming their groups and units, and they're meeting each other and they're fighting. One of the places down in Kansas known as the Battle of Blackjack, that's considered the first time in American history where the two sides that are fighting each other, that are on opposing sides, are fighting over the issue of slavery. That's what their main cause is. One is for slavery, one is against slavery. And that's what you start to see out here in this area. Well, one of the big things that occurs is, as these people are trying to make it out here, a lot of the Northerners, the easiest way to get to Kansas is to actually, and you can't, it's not on the map, but if you just go right through the middle of Missouri, that's where the Missouri River flows, and then it comes up to the eastern border of Nebraska. Well, the easiest way to get to Kansas is actually go up the steamboat up the river. Well, what starts to happen is a lot of these people who are living in Missouri, they actually start boarding the boats and taking stuff, and they're telling people, you know, hey, if you're not on our side, we're not going to let you go up. And you know, they're checking accents, checking their politics, and all of that. And a guy by the name of Jim Lane, he actually tries to take a group up the Missouri River. And that's what happens to them. They're stopped like four or five times, and they finally turn back, and he regroups in Chicago and says, there's got to be a different way to get into Kansas. And so what he does is he forms this small army, and they go to Iowa City, and then they form a wagon train, get all the equipment they need, and they go across the southern part of Iowa, roughly where Highway 34 runs now, and then they cross over into Nebraska City, because across the river from Nebraska City is Iowa. And then they come down through the southeast part of Nebraska, and then they go into Kansas. That way, they're bypassing the slave state of Missouri. They don't have to go through there anymore. And that's an important moment, because what starts to happen after that is they realize, hey, this is a pretty good way to get people into Kansas. This might be a pretty good way to get people out. Because when the Kansas-Nebraska Act is passed, you have the Missouri River until you get to about Kansas City, but then anywhere below that, the border between Kansas and Missouri, it's not a natural barrier. It's just a line on a map. And so people are, you know, they're hearing about this. They know about it, and they're trying to escape out of slavery, and they're making it into Kansas. Well, a couple of individuals, John Brown, usually referenced with it, John Armstrong, I believe his first name's John Armstrong, I'm trying to remember now, and Dr. Ira Blanchard, who actually lived in southwest Iowa, they get together and say, hey, this might be a good way to, you know, to get people out. And so you start to see that formation of an underground railroad out here on the Great Plains, where people are escaping mainly out of western Missouri. You probably have a few people from Arkansas, maybe some from Indian Territory, what is now Oklahoma. Because a lot of the times, I always say history can be complicated because people can be complicated. Because a lot of the tribes that were living there, you know, the Cherokee and the Choctaw, some of them had adopted the white ways of owning slaves. Now, I'm not going to say it's all quite the same, but like I said, it becomes really complicated with all this going on. Well, a lot of these people, they're making it in northeast Kansas, and then they come up to southeast Nebraska, and a lot of times when they make it to Nebraska City, they're going to cross the river because it is the free state of Iowa. Anywhere south of there, you know, you're going to be back in the slave state of Missouri. And so that's what you have. This becomes known as the Jim Lane Trail, just named after him. And about any picture you see that one, any picture you look at of Jim Lane, he's usually got crazy hair, and he was a very interesting character, to say the least. He was somebody, you know, they talk about some of the politicians we have today flip-flopping and saying, oh, well, you were on this side of the issue. Jim Lane is like the classic example of this, because he was a representative from Indiana. He voted for the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and then he decided, well, we really need to make sure that Kansas and Nebraska are a free territory. And so then he starts forming the group. And you got to remember, a lot of the people that come to Kansas, they're not necessarily people who want equal rights, you know, for former slaves or African Americans. And Jim Lane was one of them to start with. He just said, hey, we want to make sure Kansas is a free territory, but we also want to keep certain people out. Well, later, he becomes the head of one of the first United States Colored Troop regiments in the Civil War. So he always seemed to be following, you know, different political winds and things like that. Okay, well, that brings us to now we've, you know, have a background on what's happening, how this issue of slavery is affecting the United States, and that brings us to Alan and Barbara Mayhew and the John Kagi. And these are the people that are associated with the museum and site that, you know, that I'm involved with. And Alan and Barbara Mayhew moved to Nebraska in 1854, and they built the cabin the next year in 1855. And they became a site of assistance, a site helping people escape out of slavery. And how that happened was Barbara had a younger brother by the name of John Kagi. And John Kagi actually came to Nebraska, stayed with his sister for a few months, and then he went south to Kansas to try and make sure it became a free territory and a free state. And while in Kansas, he met the famous abolitionist John Brown. And that's where the connection comes in. That's how the site becomes known as the John Brown's Cave Site. Even though we actually, I will say, we don't have the documentation that John Brown ever visited. But how it becomes known as that is this connection to John Kagi. And John Kagi became a very close associate of John Brown's, and was with John Brown all the way to the end. Well, John Kagi starts, you know, to help, starts becoming involved in Underground Railroad and starts helping people escape out of slavery. John Kagi and John Brown met, you know, in 1856, and by 1857 is when you start to see escapes and these, almost like these runs of the Underground Railroad happening. And John Kagi, generally how this would work, and this is, you know, it's the Underground Railroad overall wasn't as an organized effort as much as history has made it out to be. I mean, there were certain areas that there was a very organized effort occurring, but a lot of times the Underground Railroad, all that meant was, here's somebody that's taken in the initiative, and that's where it always had to start, the individual, the person that is enslaved. They always had to take the initiative on whether they were going to escape from slavery or not. Very few times do they actually have somebody else, you know, free them or help them get free, you know, either violently or in a physical manner. I mean, you had times where people would get enough money and buy their freedom, But a lot of times they're not really physically freed except on their own initiative. And so eventually what would happen is a lot of these people, they'd finally make it to a place. Hey, I'd really like some food, some help. And for some of these people, they wouldn't consider themselves Underground Railroad conductors. They just, somebody comes to the door and I'm faced with a decision on, do I help this person or not help this person? And that's what happens a lot of times, especially when you go back east. But out here, there seemed to be a much more organized effort with John Kagi and John Brown and different individuals, because what would happen is these people would make it out of Missouri, make it into Kansas. Well, John Kagi, there's a few times where they talk about basically escorting a group all the way to Kansas, into Nebraska, and into Iowa, and then generally they would turn them over to somebody else once they got into southwest Iowa. And the other thing is, too, with all the violence that's happening and everything that's occurring, these guys are armed pretty well. They're ready for a fight at any moment. And, I don't know if the same case can be said as much back east, but especially out here with everything that's happening, that's how it worked. And actually, there is a story, one of the first references to an escape that John Kagi's involved with. They're coming up through Nebraska, and it's like January, early that year. And usually January's pretty cold, and there's a lot of snow, and there's a lot of ice. Well, they make it to Nebraska City. They want to get across the river, and the guy who's running the ferry or running the boat to help get across the river says, hey, I'm not doing it. There's too much ice in the river. And the way this story goes is John Kagi pulled a gun on him and said, hey, we need to get across right now. Because they actually had some of these people that were known as slave hunters or slave catchers, whatever you want to call them, that were usually sent out or hired to try and catch the fugitive slaves or escaping slaves. And there's no record that they didn't make it across, but that's one of the stories that's referenced in the local history books talking about John Kagi. Well, who are some of the other people involved, and how, exactly where are they going? Okay, let me do this real quick. So, like I said, generally, you're down here in Kansas. One of the first stops when you're coming into Nebraska is the town of Falls City. And what's interesting about the town of Falls City is when Jim Lane was coming across Iowa and he makes it to Nebraska, and when they come down through southeast Nebraska, they stop before they make it into Kansas, and they stop atop this hill and camp out. And Jim Lane's like, hey, this would be a nice place to form a town, kind of like a last depot before we enter the battleground of Kansas. And that's where Falls City, that area, or that spot is where Falls City is founded. And the way the story goes is they actually wanted to call it Lanesville. And Jim Lane and some other people were like, yeah, you don't want to do that. That wouldn't be good for you guys. So they ended up calling it, there's like a small falls on the river nearby, so they call it Falls City. And a lot of people that move to that community are abolitionists, are opposed to slavery. And so that would be considered the first stop on the Underground Railroad when you get to Nebraska. And there's a David and Ann Dorrington that lived there. And there's references to them being involved. And there's also references to another person known as Judge Dundee that lived in Falls City. Some of you might know him more famous for the 1879 Standing Bear trial. Same guy. Judge Elmer Dundee lived in Falls City. There's references that he was involved in the Underground Railroad when he was there in the late 1850s, early 1860s. And even the newspaper, you got to remember at that time, the Democratic Party, that was the party of slavery. If you were a slave owner, more than likely, that's who you're going to be voting for. You had some people that were still voting for maybe some older party factions. But you're not going to be involved with the Republican Party. The Republican Party is not an official party until 1854, because it's actually formed in response to the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And one of its big things is it doesn't want the outright abolishment of slavery, but it wants to stop the extension or expansion of slavery. And a lot of the people who moved to Falls City, they fall under the political party of the Republican Party. And even the newspaper, is promoting those positions. And then generally the next stop from there was the village of Nemahal. If you look at the map, they call it Nemahal City. And there's a lot of places that always put city on their name, because it's always hoped that we're going to be a big city and we're going to have a lot of people living here. Well, Nemahal or Nemahal City, you know, that was the same thing. They had a small newspaper going, the Republican newspaper promoted anti-slavery views. One of the references of the people there that helped was a Houston Russell. And actually, this the person that talks about it was in their later years, but Alice Minnick. And if my memory serves correctly, she was the first woman to graduate from the University of Nebraska Law School. And she talks about going to the Russell Farm and actually going down into a cellar or cave area and finding some people that were staying down there, and she couldn't hardly see them. I think in her book she actually says the only thing she could see was the whites of their eyes and see their mouth, referencing that they're African-Americans or people who escaped from slavery. And then generally you go farther north, past Peru, going just north of Peru, like another 4 or 5 miles, there was not an official town, but like a rural settlement called Camp Creek. And one of the people that lived in Camp Creek was Abraham Kagi, the father to John Kagi and Barbara Mayhew, and actually their sister, Mary, also lived there as well. And there was another story that talked about where Abraham Kagi actually assisted his son, John, on an escape where he took over and drove the wagon that the escaping slaves were hiding in while John kind of tried to divert people the other way. Because like I said, it's dangerous what they are doing. And then finally, you'd make it to Nebraska City, and you've got the cabin there. So you had Barbara, and generally, you know, they could stay there just for a minute. But a lot of times, they're not going to stay there very long. Maybe get a little bit of rest, maybe get some food, and then they're just going to keep moving. They're going to try and keep on their way. You know, you didn't want to stay in one place too long, especially if you had people after you. And the references that we have is one of the Mayhew sons, actually the oldest Mayhew son, talks about his Uncle John stopping by, and he had a pretty large group of escaping slaves with him, and that his mother fed them cornbread, and then they were on their way. And John Kagi actually wrote a letter from Tabor, Iowa, you know, about 30 miles or so up the road, and you can see it because you got Nebraska City, and the next little dot, that's the town of Civil Bend. That would have been the next stop, and then you got the town of Tabor. And usually they could stay a little bit longer in Tabor. Everybody there, you know, were abolitionists, opposed to slavery. A lot of them helped on the Underground Railroad. And John actually writes a letter and talks about that the local authorities had showed up at his sister's place while he was there. And they decided they needed more men. And by the time they came back, he had escaped and made it on his way. And generally, like I said, once you get to Nebraska City, you're going to cross the river, make it into Iowa, and then you got to remember, they're still going to make it go all the way across the state of Iowa, into Illinois, to Chicago, and for a lot of them, they're still going to go across the Great Lakes in Michigan and finally make it into Canada. And what we had happen this last year, and John Brown and John Kagi, what they did in late 1858 is they actually, them and a group of men went into western Missouri, and they physically freed 11 people. You know, one person was killed on one farm, and then the other one, they were able to, you know, they held people at gunpoint and said, hey, this is what we're doing, and we're going back in to Kansas with them. And so that happens late 1858, early 1859, and they came up through Nebraska territory with that group. And it was 11 people at the time. It was soon became 12 because one of the women was very pregnant and actually gave birth to a son on the trip, which they named John Brown. And they lead that group, personally lead them all the way to Canada. And one of our board members this last year actually connected with one of the, with a person who is a descendant of one of those freedom seekers or escaping slaves on that group. And they still live in Canada to this day, which I thought was pretty incredible. But you got to remember, like I said, Nebraska City was not an anti-slavery community. And so they actually talk about John Brown and his group coming through Nebraska City. Pretty explicit language. Read, ye who are attacked with negrophobia. And it's talking about John Brown being a horse thief. And generally, if you're a horse thief, that was one of the worst things you could be, because horses were used for travel, for work, for all of this stuff, and that's like your livelihood. And they're talking about John Brown and John Kagi and these men even being lower than a horse thief. So pretty incredible stuff. Well, one of the things that happens, and I wanted to come back to it, is I mentioned Stephen Knuckles had a couple slaves, lived in Nebraska City, had a couple girls that, who escaped from him. That actually becomes a very publicized escape on the Underground Railroad. And we talked about Wilbur Siebert in his book. There's like a page or two devoted just to Stephen Knuckles and these two girls escaping in his book. And he actually says it's probably one of the most well-known, if not the most well-known, publicized escape on the Underground Railroad in American history. Well, what happens is Knuckles, these two girls escape. It's late November 1858. They make it into Iowa. The local newspaper, the Nebraska newspaper, talks about a group of about 70 men gathering together. They go over into the state of Iowa. They actually beat a couple people up and to try and recover these two girls. Well, Knuckles and a few other people keep on the trail and try to track them down, and they're just never able to catch up with them. Well, eventually what happens is one of the girls gets held in custody in Chicago. I don't remember. I've not found exactly what happens is, but Stephen Knuckles finds out. He actually goes to Chicago. This is like in the middle of 1860, so you're talking over a year and a half later, and he's still not forgotten. And he goes all the way to Chicago to try and get this one girl back, and he actually does get her, and he's trying to leave town. Well, what happens is there's a group of people who know what he's doing, know what he's there for, and they put a stop to it. I mean, to put it bluntly, they're a mob, and they say, hey, we know what you're doing, and we're not going to let you do it. And so they're able to take the girl from him, and by all accounts, Mr. Knuckles has to escape with his life, and he's able to make it without injury and without being killed. And I always, and we do have a newspaper article that talks about that event. But the other part of the story that we've not been able to find documentation for, and I would think it would be very interesting to do, is that Mr. Knuckles had to be disguised as a woman to get out of Chicago. And I always thought he would make a pretty interesting woman. But, and, I mean, and this is all happening, this is all connected to, you know, the state of Nebraska. And actually, this newspaper article is from The Liberator, which was published by William Lloyd Garrison, one of the more famous abolitionists, helped founded abolitionist and anti-slavery societies in America. And, you know, he's even talking about it. And like I said, Siebert says this is probably one of the most well-known, if not the most well-known, escape on the Underground Railroad, is this escape of Mr. Knuckles' slaves. Well, as far as the story of John Kagi and John Brown, what eventually happens is John Brown, he said he had dedicated his life to ending slavery. Well, finally, he has thought up an idea on how to do that. Well, John Brown takes a group of men, they go back east to a place called Harper's Ferry, what is Virginia, it's now West Virginia, and that's where one of the federal arsenals there. So there's lots of weapons and guns and different equipment that they want to use to be able to kind of form an army and end slavery. And so the idea is, hey, we're going to get some of this stuff, we're going to get out, we're going to go start freeing slaves, we're going to form an army, and eventually the property, quote-unquote property, of these Southerners is, you know, not going to be sustainable, because we're going to basically go around and continue to free people and form a big enough army that they're not going to be able to resist what we're going to do. Well, it doesn't work. John Kagi, and like I said, John Kagi stuck with John Brown all the way in. He's usually listed as second in command in a lot of the books and stuff, only behind John Brown at Harper's Ferry. Well, these guys, they're eventually surrounded. There's only a group of 21 of them. They're surrounded. Some of them are captured. John Kagi, he's actually shot and killed while trying to escape at the age of 24. And this is all in October 1859. John Brown, he's eventually captured, tried for treason against the state of Virginia, caused insurrection and murder. He's found guilty after a 3.5-day trial and is sentenced to be executed, which does happen, death by hanging on December 2nd, 1859. But as far as the story, and that's where their story, I don't want to say it ends, because their actions there resonate throughout the United States, because the people who are abolitionists, who are opposed to slavery, say, yes, this is the best news we've heard, because here you have somebody that's trying to finally strike against slavery in an area of slavery. And of course, the Southerners, they're totally shocked and really scared now, and they're starting to go a little crazy, like, hey, you know what, we knew it, every person in the North that's opposed to slavery, this is what they are, they're all John Brown just out there waiting to get us. And so this really heightens the emotions even more. And you know, John Brown, just one person's actions, you know, probably no one person can be pointed to as a cause of the Civil War. Now, really, if you talk about the most immediate cause why the United States split, you will look at the election of 1860 with Abraham Lincoln being elected president. But it could have been John C. Fremont or anybody else running as a Republican candidate. They were probably going to secede if a Republican was elected president. But John Brown and John Kagi and the men at Harper's Ferry, they really, you know, heightened the emotions even further. Well, as far as the Underground Railroad out in Nebraska, for the most part, there's references that it continued into 1860, 1861, while the war is going on. You know, it was Missouri, even though it's a Union state, it's a slave state, so there's a lot of division on what's happening there. And you still continue to see, you know, escapes into western Missouri, you know, out of western Missouri into Kansas, up to Nebraska. And eventually, you know, at the end of the Civil War, the 13th Amendment is passed, which officially abolishes slavery or involuntary servitude. And you actually start to see this remembering or remembrance of the Underground Railroad. Even though Nebraska City was a pro-slavery community, they attached themselves to the site of the Mayhew Cabin, you know, as a symbol of, yeah, we were opposed to slavery before the war, is, as I always put it, you know, to try to be on the right side of history. And so in the late 30s, the site was actually open to the public, and for the most part, it has been open to the public for people to come and visit since then. And I think, you know, for me, one of the, you know, if you want to talk about legacies or of the Underground Railroad, you know, one of the things that's usually pointed out is it's kind of considered really like the first civil rights movement. Here you have different types of people working together to try and achieve the goal to make sure, you know, people are free, make sure that they try and enjoy what this country says that it offers to everybody. And I think that would be the biggest legacy to point out. And a lot of these sites, like I said, our site is still open for people to see. There are sites in Kansas that people can go visit. There are sites in Iowa that still exist that people can go visit. And with that, I will quit talking. I guess, do we have... Oh, okay. If you guys want to clap, that's okay. It doesn't matter to me. Did you see Table Rock on the map? I don't know if it is actually on this map or not, because this clings to... Because generally, where the town of Table Rock is at this moment is farther west, but there are references to even a little farther west, places like Table Rock. There's references in some newspapers, and there's actually a gentleman who wrote a diary who was leading a group out of Kansas, talks about crossing around Table Rock, and we're pretty sure it's the same place, but we got to keep doing some research. And that's the other thing. Generally, one of the questions that's asked is how many people, you know, came through the cabin or escaped through Nebraska. Dr. Sarah Crook of Peru State College, who's done quite a bit of research on this, her and I have generally come to the agreement of about maybe 100, maybe 150 people. Now, that's not a lot, But as I always say, it mattered to each individual person that did escape. But we're always wondering if that number should be a little higher, because when we were at a conference a few years ago in Kansas, they're talking about all these different accounts of people escaping into Kansas and then actually making it up way to Nebraska. And one of them is this diary. It's Reverend Bodwell is the guy's name, and he actually talks about, mentions a Table Rock while escaping, or while leading these people on an escape. And that's the thing. We don't know if it's just a difference in record keeping by the people that lived at the time, or if it just there aren't a lot. But like I said, we're wondering if it should be more. But you got to remember, it was also illegal. So some people did keep diaries. Some people did keep records. Others didn't. They just did what they felt was right.
As yourself as a historian, I understand that slavery is really a black mark on the conscience of the United States. But I suspect, and this is where I'm asking you, the United States in some ways was a forerunner in ending slavery, because I want to know what was the broad perspective of slavery in other continents. When did they start dealing with this whole issue? It seems like we obviously had to deal with it. I'm not discounting that. But it seems like the United States was a forerunner in saying, hey, we don't want this here. And other places in the world who continue to have slavery were slow to be doing these kind of things. Am I right or am I incorrect in this perception?
Well, I wouldn't say the United States was a forerunner in regards of ending slavery, because actually the first government to finally say, or first country to finally say, we're going to abolish slavery and end slavery was England in like 1831, 1832. No, actually, I think it was 1833. I can't remember. And the people, you got to remember, Canada is actually still at this time part of the British Empire, and they celebrate that up there. A lot of these people who escape out of slavery that move into Canada, they actually celebrate that holiday, and they talk about, hey, this is, you know, such a great day. Here you have, you know, one of the major powers in the world ending slavery. Now, the United States, part of the issue for them is you had a group of people that were going to hang on to it, because originally, and, you know, a couple of classes I've taken, I had one professor that I always felt said it best. The founding fathers and the people that formed the United States, it was always this idea of someday, somehow, it's going to end. Slavery's going to go away. It's a necessary evil. But the problem is when the cotton gin is modified, you know, I was reading this, you always hear about Eli Whitney inventing the cotton gin in 1793. Well, I was reading other sources where they say he didn't invent it, he just modified it to where it works a lot better. Well, when that happens, the production of cotton goes up and up and up exponentially. And the, you know, exporting cotton goes up and up. And actually, cotton was the leading exporter of the United States from, in, you know, like the 1820s all the way up until like the late 1930s. That's how big this becomes. And so you have, so it wasn't going at that. And then there's a shift in thinking. It's no longer a necessary evil. It is now a positive good. And you had a lot of the people in the North, I would say, that were, you know, maybe not necessarily front runners, but leading the way on the moral crusade against slavery. And, you know, you got to remember, too, a lot of the people that are opposed to slavery and want to see slavery abolished, they're not for equal rights for everybody. But for a couple of people that moved out in this area, like some of the people in Tabor, like a John Todd, he come from a place called Oberlin College in Ohio. Well, these people are all about, you know, it's considered the first college to admit African Americans, the first college to admit women. And so you have some of these people that are trying to fight for that. So, you know, John Brown did say there is going to have to be some bloodshed for this to happen. And as we all know, that is what occurred when the American Civil War started in 1861.
I was just curious, when they were going on this trail, was it usually just one massive group, or were there multiple groups that ran at the same time? And approximately how many people would accompany the escaping slaves during this? Would it be groups of 5, 10, or is it one or two at a time that were accompanying these groups? I'm just curious about how the numbers worked out on that?
And the numbers are always difficult to judge. But a lot of times when you're talking about John Kagi, there's the references talk about just John Kagi maybe having a couple people with him. Now, they weren't the only ones doing this, and that's the problem, is we don't necessarily have a lot of other names and things like that. But more often than not, you have a couple people. They've got a group of escaping slaves. They probably got four or five. Usually not a large number. Now, that last one that came through when they were talking about John Kagi, that was a group of like 11 or 12. And if any of you guys have been to the Mayhew Cabin or come to the Mayhew Cabin, that would have been a really large group to have in a 14 by 16-foot cabin. Because a lot of the times if you get too large of a group, you know, you're going to start drawing some suspicion. But when it starts to happen out here in the late 1850s, early 1860s, it's kind of hard not to, because most of the time, the people that are escaping from slavery are young adults. Why is that? Well, generally, you don't have a family yet. You don't have maybe as much of a connection, and you're probably more stronger and more able to do it. Because the thing is, you know, when I'm talking to kids, I say, well, would you have escaped? Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it wasn't that easy. We all, looking back, say, yeah, yeah, no problem, no problem. But you know, I have a family at home, and if I leave, I may not be able to take everybody with me. And that's a decision that I have to weigh. And then also, the other thing is, we don't know exactly what's out there. The unknown is usually a pretty fearful thing for human beings, for people. It's like, okay, I know where I'm at right now. It's not the best place, and I don't really want to be here. But you know, if I do this, I don't know what's out there. I don't know what I'm going to find. I don't know who I'm going to run into, and I don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, and these are all decisions that each individual had to make.
We'd like to thank you very much, and thank Humanities Nebraska for sponsoring this presentation.
And if anybody you want to ask me more questions, want to come down and talk to me, that's totally fine. I've actually got copies of some other newspaper articles from the Nebraska City Paper. And as most of you probably tell, I like talking about history. I like studying history. That's my background. That's what my degrees are in from Peru State. And thank you guys very much. And I hope you guys learned something today and all that good stuff.
You've been listening to a lecture program for Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a talk by Bill Hayes, the director of John Brown's Cave Museum, part of the Mayhew Cabin and Historic Village in Nebraska City. He spoke on the topic, The Fight Against Slavery on the Great Plains, Nebraska's Underground Railroad. This program, co-sponsored by Humanities Nebraska, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, February 10th, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.